Balanced Energy with naturopath and medical intuitive Dr. Rita Louise. We have learned from Einstein's theories that matter and energy are one. Physicists believe that all systems in nature have their own particular way of vibrating. From the swing of a pendulum to the waves in the ocean to the light that brightens the sky each day, each of these oscillates at its own unique rate. In the same way, things such as rocks and minerals vibrate very slowly and at speeds that are imperceptible to us. Living things such as plants, animals, and man vibrate faster and appear to be alive. The same holds true for every thought, feeling, event, or word we speak. Each has its own frequency or rate of vibration. What many of us don't realize is if we take everything in our own universe down to its simplest form, it is all just energy. Join Dr. Rita as she explores questions such as, what are we made of? Why do we get sick? How can I live a more balanced and whole life? Call in and talk to her and her thought-provoking guests. Send us your questions and get the help you need to move beyond any obstacles or challenges that may be affecting your life, right from the source. So stay tuned and explore your possibility.
Hello and welcome to Just Energy Radio. I'm Dr. Rita Louise, and thank you all for tuning into the show today. We have a great show lined up today. In the first hour, we're going to be talking to John Welshond about his new book, One Soul, One Love, One Heart. Can't wait to get him on. It was a great book. Good stuff. And in the second hour, we're going to be talking to Don Dennis from Texas Paranormal about paranormal investigations. But I have a couple of announcements before we bring John on. Some events that are coming up that I'm going to be at, and you can come visit with me. In the Dallas-Fort Worth area, the Wellness Expo is scheduled for February 27th and 28th. I will be there on the 28th speaking about medical intuition. This is in Fort Worth. March 13th, 2010, I'll be in the Beaumont Civic Center at the Texas Go Show, and you can get information about that at www.txparanormal.com, but I'm sure we'll be talking more about that in the second hour. And then March 27th, I will be at the Spirit Spectacular Show with my good friends in Minneapolis, Minnesota. That's scheduled for March 27th at the Crown Plaza Hotel. Anyway, so let me talk a little bit about John, and we will get him on the air. John Welshond is the author of When Prayers Aren't Answered and Awakening from Grief. A much sought-after speaker who offers lectures and workshops on terminal illness, grief, and other topics, he has been helping people deal with dramatic life change and loss for over 35 years. He is the founder and president of Open Heart Seminars and lives in New Jersey. And then his new book, One Heart, One Love, or One Soul, One Heart, One Love, The Sacred Path to Healing All Relationships. So please welcome to Just Energy Radio, John Welshond. Hi, John. How are you?
Hi, I'm great, Dr. Rita. How are you?
I am excellent. Thank you so much for coming on to the show.
Thanks for having
John,
me.
John, I have to tell you, when they had sent me information about your book and I got your book, my first hit was it was going to be just another relationship book, you know, forgiveness, fix this, you know, communication, you know, that self-help stuff that's really popular right now.
Right.
What really surprised me was that your book didn't talk about those kinds of things, but more importantly, it talked about healing our relationships with ourselves.
Mm.
Why is it so important to heal ourselves in order to have happiness in our relationships?
Well, because our relationship with ourselves and I guess I would just specify right now that we actually have two selves. We have our personality and our body and so on. And then we have our big self, which is our soul or our divine consciousness or Buddha nature. And our relationship with the world is entirely determined by our relationship with our two selves, basically. So that we're really striving to develop and cultivate and deepen the relationship with the big self, with our soul. But we see the world through the eyes of our small s self, through our personality, through the prism of the experiences that we've had thus far in life. And if you subscribe to reincarnation, well, then we're seeing also through the prism of experiences we may carry over from previous incarnations. So we really don't see the world clearly. We're seeing it all through this prism of our wounds and injuries and psychological and emotional problems, and we're really not seeing clearly. So the healing of all relationships really starts with the healing of our relationship with ourself.
With you talking about that, it made me think of, and I'm pretty sure it was Gary Zukav's Seed of the Soul book, mm-hmm. where he talks about, you know, when you're your authentic self, you can't tell where the personality ends and the soul begins, because it's just one straight line in and one straight line out, and you're congruent on the inside as well as the outside.
Exactly. Yeah, that's it. And, you know, it's interesting because somebody called me up recently and said, well, do you have any ego left? And I said, I sure do. You know, I've been meditating for 40 years. It hasn't gone anywhere. The difference is that what the spiritual path does is it gets you less attached to your ego, less constricted by your ego. So, I mean, every enlightened being has a personality, a distinct and unique personality. But that isn't really the totality of who they are, because they're really coming from the authentic self or the soul. You know, that's really where they're rooted. And when you're rooted in that, you really don't get so lost in all of the neuroses and uproar and, you know, insecurities that exist in our human minds.
And I think when you're following a spiritual path or working to be more authentic, it gives you the opportunity to kind of take a step back and look at the world, reality, from a different perspective, and then make different choices of how to act or how you're choosing to react.
Exactly, yeah. So that when you're living in your soul, in your big S self, you're really feeling the connection to everything. You know, I mean, the introduction to your show is so beautiful because it really talks about how through physics we understand that everything is energy, just vibrating at different rates of speed and different frequencies, but it's all the same energy. There's only one energy in the whole universe. So that, you know, sometimes people ask me what my concept of God is, and that's really it, that it is that one energy that exists at the core of the universe, that is the only thing really that exists in the universe, and it infuses everything in form, every human being, every rock, every stone, every tree, every car, you know, even man-made things are still made up of that same one energy. And that really is the place in which we start to understand the meaning of the phrase, we're all one. You know, it isn't a philosophical oneness, it's a literal oneness, so that when you feel suffering at some level, I'm going to feel it too, you know, because it's in the atmosphere. It's like that thing that most of us have experienced at one time or another of having someone pop into our minds that we haven't thought of in years, and a few minutes later the phone rings and it's them. You know, how would that happen if we weren't all connected in one vast web of consciousness? So really healing our relationships starts with understanding that and feeling it and recognizing that if we're all one, then I can't turn away from your suffering. I can't turn away from your difficulties. And at the same time, whatever joy or happiness or peace we're able to create, we're both going to benefit from. So, you know, it works two ways. And that's really the core of the understanding in one soul, one love, one heart, that we have, there is just one soul, one love, one heart that we all share. And love turns out to be the way that we get most easily in touch with that place of oneness and that one energy.
You were talking about, you know, the phone and stuff like that. I mean, I just call that, well, you were having a psychic experience because, you know, we send out those vibes into the universe and we pick them up.
Uh-huh.
And it's interesting because you're talking about changing yourself. And one of the things that I tell to my clients and stuff like that is if you're in a relationship and you want the relationship to change, if you change yourself and you change that vibe you're sending out into the universe, the people that you're interacting with have no choice but to react to you in a different way because you're not vibrating in the same way you were before.
Right, right. Now, but the interesting thing about that is that the change isn't always going to be necessarily what you're looking for, you know?
Sometimes it's not what they're looking for either.
That's right. That's right. Meaning that, you know, if you start to, I mean, sometimes people are caught in these dances of, you know, one neurosis feeding the other neurosis. You know, it's like you scratch my neurosis and I'll scratch yours, and that's the basis of a relationship. If one of the partners starts to say, well, I think my work in this lifetime is to be less neurotic, the other person may say, wow, you know, you're so much easier to be with now. Or they may say, hey, you're not playing our game anymore. I don't like that.
Exactly.
Yeah. So,
I would say, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, spiritual growth in relationship, it really requires two to agree that, you know, we agree on the what our relationship is about. And sometimes that agreement is done very unconsciously at the outset. And if one of the partners starts to become more conscious and the other doesn't go for that, you know, that's just the way that is. But if you're becoming more conscious, you can, if your partner wants to go on that journey with you, it's just beautiful. If they don't, if you're becoming more conscious, ultimately, you will be stronger, and the parting in that relationship will be easier. So sometimes the greatest way to heal a relationship, in a sense, is to end it, you know, because it's not really serving for the highest good of both partners.
Mm-hmm.
So the outcome, you know, is never necessarily certain. Theoretically, we would love to be able to heal every relationship, but sometimes the healing can only take place in our own being because the other person is not on board with what we're trying to do, basically.
No, I totally hear you. I would say over the past, I'm going to say 5 years. I mean, I've been doing this work a long time, so I'm just going to say 5 years. I've had so many female clients, and I don't know if it's because of their age or because of where we are in our, you know, group evolutionary process, that have really been working on owning their energy and recreating their self-esteem. And then their comment is, but everybody hates me. And it's like, well, yeah, that happens. You know, because you're changing that vibration, and some will choose to follow along, and others will say, well, you're not going to be my doormat anymore, or I can't suck your energy anymore, so
right.
I'm out of here. I'm going to go find somebody else that I can drain.
Yeah.
Sad as that may be.
One of the most clear ways to see that is if you've been, you know, involved in an addictive lifestyle, and you know, let's say you drink, and suddenly you say, well, I don't want to do that anymore because it's just not serving my happiness, you know? And so all your old drinking buddies say, wow, you're really becoming boring. We don't want to be with you anymore. You know, what are you, you holier than thou? You don't want to be with us? So that kind of thing can happen in many realms of life. It doesn't just have to revolve around addiction. But, you know, sometimes some people, you know, just have an addiction to being miserable, to being unhappy. And if you try to cultivate happiness in your life, Some of them, again, may get a vicarious high from that and say, wow, you know, it's so nice being around you now. And others will say, it's too scary being around you now. So it's all, that's why, you know, all going back to your original question of why the first thing and the main thing that we do in healing relationships is healing our relationship with ourselves. Doesn't necessarily mean that the relationships are going to change in the way we might like them to change. But they might.
Mm-hmm.
They might. The important thing is...
You can pray on it.
Yeah. And I also think that we really can't be fully happy and have healthy relationships with other human beings until we find a way to be happy by ourselves and have a really good relationship with ourselves. You know, many people in this culture cannot sit in a room alone with themselves. They just don't like, you know, they don't like the company. And so driven into relationship with other human beings to try and escape from the relationship with themselves. And that corrupts a lot of relationships. So one of the things that I really like to share with people is cultivate that relationship with yourself to the point that you never feel alone and you don't have to be with other people in order to distract yourself from the fact that you're not comfortable with yourself. You know, get comfortable with yourself. And that is one of the greatest gifts you can give yourself.
That is so scary for some people.
Of course.
So scary.
You know, on the, I was just on another radio show earlier today, and I was telling a story that's in One Soul, One Love, One Heart about the Dalai Lama. Amazing insight that I got. Buddhism really is, to me, a system of psychology. It's a really very sophisticated understanding of the human mind and how it works. It has nothing to do with theological questions. It's really about psychological issues. And the thought patterns that lead to happiness and the thought patterns that lead to suffering. Now, a number of years ago, I mean, there have been a lot of Western psychologists who have gotten very interested in Buddhism. And a group of them decided that they would have an annual conference with the Dalai Lama to discuss similarities and differences between Buddhist psychology and Western psychology. And in a videotape I was watching of one of these conferences a number of years ago, was one of the first ones, one of the Western psychologists mentioned the term low self-esteem. Now, low self-esteem is something that is so familiar to most Americans and most Westerners. You know, we all have low self-esteem. It's, you know, an epidemic. And so this man mentioned low self-esteem. The Dalai Lama looked puzzled. And he looked at him and he said, "Can you repeat that? What did you just say?" And he said, "Low self-esteem." The Dalai Lama is still puzzled. He turns and he looks at his translator. He says, "Can you translate that into Tibetan?" And the translator thinks for a moment. He says, "No, we don't have that concept." And when the Dalai Lama just sort of sat back in his chair, and he got this expression on his face, which to me I sort of read as being, my goodness, can Westerners ever come up with some extraordinary ways to suffer? You know, low self-esteem? How could you have low self-esteem?
And then he had that little twinkle in his eye.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, what I got from that was I started thinking about his culture, and I thought, well, in his culture, when a child is born, the community gathers to celebrate the birth of a celestial being. You know, it's like this god or goddess has come into form. How wonderful. Thank you for joining us. We're blessed by your mere presence on earth. And in our culture, when a baby is born, the community gathers because everybody loves babies. But right away, we start saying things like, oh, what a beautiful baby. Maybe she'll be president of the United States someday. Or maybe he'll be a great doctor and discover the cure for cancer. Or maybe she'll be this, or he'll be that. And all of a sudden we have all of this expectation that we're setting up and a message that we're giving to babies, as, even when they're infants. We're saying, we value you in terms of what you can achieve and what you acquire and who you become and how much you have in the bank, those are the measurements of your value in this culture. It isn't your inner being. It's what you do and what you become. And that really gives us the message that our happiness and our value is determined by things external to us. And when we start,
well, it sounds like they're only supporting the small s, as
you small s self. Yeah, exactly. And the problem with that is not that there's anything wrong or evil about the small s self, our personality, our body, and so on, our mind. But we can't really gain fulfillment through that. You know, the problem is it's like chasing a mirage. You know, I was also telling the story of a friend of mine who has $10 million in the bank, and he wants $100 million. He's not happy with $10 million, you know, because when you're looking for happiness outside yourself, you never get to it. It's chasing a mirage, you know. So you get to that $10 million or whatever the number is. You know, a lot of people say, well, if I had, you know, if I had any money in the bank, I'd be happy. But, you know, I mean, that doesn't change really substantially with the amount of money, because as long as you're looking for happiness outside yourself, you're not going to find it. That's the problem with trying to get self-esteem for the small s self without honoring and acknowledging the big s self, or our divine nature, that part of us that never changes, the part of us that is never born and never dies, you know? The part of us that is that one energy that infuses the entire universe. That's where happiness comes from. That's where love is. That's where joy is and peace. It's all inside us.
But it seems like our society does not nurture that part at all. I mean, it doesn't nurture our ability to experience and have emotions. It doesn't, you know, nurture anymore, in particular, our creative side. I mean, you hear, you know, the artist that wants to pursue art or music, and they're told, are you crazy? You can't make any money doing that. And they aren't themselves. You know, they're
right.
Doing these things that they don't even want to do,
right,
and aren't loving themselves, honoring themselves.
Right. Well, and so you're absolutely right about that. And so what it requires, finding real peace and happiness and fulfillment in life, often requires some mechanism in your life, some way in which you understand that you're going to have to go against the cultural model of how you find happiness, because you can't find happiness through that model. And, you know, as you mentioned, think of how many millions of people in this culture are feeling imprisoned in a life that they hate, you know, because they've got financial responsibilities or financial demands, because they have, you know, I mean, here's one of the things is that we think that if we buy more things, we'll be happy. And so we go out and load up our credit cards with credit debt, and then we have to work at a job that we hate in order to pay off the debt that we've incurred, buying things that we think will bring us happiness, which didn't bring us happiness, you know? But it gets much more vast than that, because then, you know, well, our friends just bought this new house, and we need a new, bigger house. And, you know, I can't tell you how many people I've encountered in my life who are working at a job that they hate doing because they've got a big mortgage bill to pay. And so at some point, we have to say that the cultural idea about how we find happiness doesn't work. You know, it's a lie. It's a delusion. So let's find it in the way that we, you know, look for it in the place where we really have hope of finding it, which is inside our own being. You know, this whole thing, if we look at our economic circumstance right now, and I don't want to sound like I'm coming from a political point of view. I'm just looking at it, you know, in this moment as sort of a spiritual sociologist, you know. I mean, it doesn't work. It doesn't work to have people feeling oppressed by having to do work that they don't like doing in order to get vested in a pension plan or to support all of the, you know, sort of economic addictions that we've cultivated in the culture. You know, how many people of sort of limited economic circumstance have to feel that they have to work harder to provide the money to buy incredibly expensive things that their children think they need? You know, and they're just mm-hmm. things. When wouldn't it
and
be
then they
better?
Break them, and then you have to buy them again anyway.
Exactly. or they're having to work more hours. When wouldn't it be more useful to be at home with their children, doing some simple thing that everybody that helped to connect everybody? You know, one of the things that I suggested in One Soul, One Love, One Heart is that families try to find a way to at least take one night a week when the television is turned off and all the computers are off and the cell phones and the Blackberries are off, and that family just sits and talks and gets to know each other again. And also then to find a way to go out into the community and do some service together as a family for other human beings. I think that simple things like that would begin to undercut this incredible explosion of violence and consumerism and just craziness that's going on in the world, where we're getting so far away from our spiritual heart. The spiritual heart is really where people are going to find happiness. It isn't a mystery.
But we're also getting so far away from. We're also getting so far away from each other.
Exactly.
You know, we don't have people come visit. You know, the neighbor doesn't come over with a pie.
Right.
You know?
Right.
We don't sit around and drink coffee at the kitchen table. You send
right.
an email. That's good.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting that another thing I was talking about in One Soul, One Love, One Heart is the explosion of multitasking that our children especially are doing, where they're on the computer, they're on the BlackBerry, they're on the cell phone, they've got music going on the stereo, the television is on, it's all going all the time. And, you know, it's interesting because I was reading a study recently about child psychologists looking at this. And fascinating that the older child psychologists, let's say the ones 50 and older, were saying they didn't think this was a very healthy trend. The younger ones were saying, well, they thought it was just, you know, the human being achieving a higher potential and showing that we can, in fact, do 10 different things at once. The one thing they all agreed on was that what we're doing is we're raising a generation now really into a second generation of children who cannot tolerate silence and inactivity. And mm-hmm. I don't know about you, but I don't know any path to inner happiness that doesn't really ask for the ability to be silent and inactive from time to time, you know, to learn to meditate, to look within. If you can't do that, I don't know how you undercut the agitation that's so much a problem in the culture, so that everybody's taking drugs to calm down or to numb themselves to their own depression, but not taking advantage of the things that nature naturally offers us. You know, going back to our soul, that's the most natural thing for us. It's the core of who we are, you know. And we don't look there. We look everywhere else to find happiness.
Well, actually, we're coming up on a break, so let's kind of stop here real quick.
Okay.
When we come back, there was a story in your book. It was Kitty's story, where she talks about her time with Mayor Baba. And I love the story, and I thought that it really kind of set the stage for the whole book. So maybe you can share that story when we get back.
Absolutely. I'd love to.
Okay. I'm Dr. Rita Louise. We're talking to John Welshon about his book, One Soul, One Love, One Heart, and we'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
Just Energy Radio with your host, Dr. Rita Louise, will return right after these messages.
Are you sensitive to energy? Want to explore the world beyond the five senses? Looking for a new career as an alternative healthcare practitioner? Then the Institute of Applied Energetics, Medical Intuition, and Energy Medicine Training Programs may be right for you. Our comprehensive curriculum provides students with a deep understanding of how to detect, evaluate, and transform the subtle body, as well as techniques for correcting energetic imbalances that may underscore a person's ability to experience radiant health. So if you are sensitive to energy, contact the Institute of Applied Energetics right away. Be a catalyst for changing the way healthcare is done around the world. Visit www.appliedenergeticsinstitute.com and start your new career today.
Move past the crossroads in your life and discover alternative solutions to your deepest concerns at SoulHealer.com. So whether it's a physical problem, an emotional issue, a question about work, or troubles in your relationships, naturopath and medical intuitive Dr. Rita Louise can help you. Bring peace, harmony, and health back into your life. Schedule a session today. Visit SoulHealer.com right away and live the life you've been dreaming of.
Before we get back to the show, I want to thank all of you for tuning into Just Energy Radio this evening. Many of the people I've helped over the years were listeners just like you. If you're at a junction in your life, don't stand alone at this important time. Call me or send me an email. We can set up a private consultation so that you too can experience wholeness in your life. To find out more about the services I offer, visit soulhealer.com.
And now back to Just Energy Radio with Dr. Rita Louise.
Hello and welcome back to Just Energy Radio. I'm Dr. Rita Louise and we're talking to John Wilshon. His website is onesoulonelove.com. In case you've been trying to get into the chat room or wanted to get into the chat room, sorry for not opening it up, but it is open now, so please you come visit. So, John, before the break, I mentioned Kitty's story about Mayor Baba. One comment, it seems like you've gotten to hang around with all the really cool guys, Ron Doss, and I'm like so jealous. Ooh, wait, that was ego. I'm not jealous. I'm so happy for you, but anyway, so who's Kitty, and can you share her story? Because I just thought, you know, when talking about healing our relationships, it was just a perfect example.
Well, Kitty Davey was a wonderful, wonderful woman. She was in her early 80s when I first met her back in the early 70s. And she had been an almost lifelong devotee of Meher Baba, who was a wonderful spiritual master in India who lived, I think, 1894 to 1969. Now, she had met him in 1931, and a group of people, she lived in London, and a group of people met him and were just swept up in his aura. You know, a great spiritual master is someone who is an expression of that one energy that is the foundation for the entire universe. And when someone is living in that place, they are so radiant and so magnetic and so attractive, and you just feel bliss in their presence. So that's what people felt. And they were just drawn to him. He was visiting in Europe and then came to America. And he invited a group of about 40 Westerners to come to India a year later, 1932, I think. So these 40 Westerners go to India to be with him, and they're all thinking, oh, boy, you know, being in India with our guru, this is going to be amazing. We'll all be enlightened in a few weeks, and it'll be wonderful. We'll all be like him. So they got there, and he took them on a tour around India for a couple of weeks, sort of like the honeymoon. And they had a wonderful time, and they stayed in first-class hotels and had wonderful meals and so on. And then at the end of that, he said, well, now it's time to go back to the ashram and get down to work. And they, you know, didn't really know what that meant, but they said, okay. And they got there. And at the ashram, they were each assigned to a particular roommate, and they were each given particular jobs to do. And within about 2 weeks, all of these people who went to India to become enlightened were fighting and bickering and carrying on with each other, and they were all miserable, and they all wanted to go back home. And then they started talking to each other and realizing that Meher Baba had selected each roommate and given them their work in the ashram, and that they realized that he had given each of them the roommate that they would have the most difficulty getting along with. He didn't tell them he was doing this. He just did it. And he gave them the work to do that they would least like doing. And then they started saying, well, if we could trade roommates with each other and we could trade jobs, then, you know, I wouldn't mind doing your job, and I would prefer to have your roommate, and so on. So they decided that they had it all sorted out, and it would be much better if they could do it the way they wanted to. So they asked for a meeting with Meher Baba. And he said, okay, he would meet with them the next day at 4 o'clock. And they all assemble in the meditation hall, and he looks at them very sadly, and he says, what's the matter, as if he didn't know. Well, then no one wanted to speak. But finally, Kitty raises her hand, and she stands up, and she says, well, Baba, here's the problem. We've noticed that you've assigned us roommates that we can't get along with, and you've given us jobs to do that we don't like. Now, if we could change these around and switch them, then we could have roommates we like and jobs we like, and then we'd be happy, and then we could be God with you. But the way it is, you're screwing up our enlightenment. And Baba looked at them and he said, you know, I could do that. I could give you all roommates that you find easy and jobs that you find easy to do. But what would you learn? And what came out of that was really the recognition that sometimes when we're trying to redesign our lives to make them perfect, sometimes what we're doing is we're running away from the stuff in us that's keeping us from being happy. And that maybe it would be more useful at certain times in life to, instead of running away from the person we find difficult, to find a way to love them. And instead of running away from the work that we don't like doing, to find a way to love doing that. And that is really taking the difficult parts of our lives and turning them into fuel for our spiritual growth. Now, I want to hasten to add that nothing that I'm saying and nothing that I've written in One Soul, One Love, One Heart is intended to suggest that anyone allow themselves to be abused psychologically or physically or in any other way. And it's not meant to condone cruel behavior or unkind, unconscious behavior. It's simply meant to suggest that if we live in the perspective that people who are cruel and unkind shouldn't be the way they are, well, that's problematical, because it's saying that the universe shouldn't be the way it is, because there are cruel, unkind, unconscious people on this planet. You know, now, that being said, I'm personally going to do everything I can to take away the opportunities for cruel, unkind, unconscious people to hurt other people. You know, and that, you know, up to and including putting them in jail if that's where they have to be, or in some other kind of institution. But that doesn't mean that I have to hate them or judge them for being wrong. And that's something that we really, you know, would do well to learn, is that it doesn't require us that making change in society, in our individual lives and in society as a whole, doesn't require us to be angry. Maybe we could do it from love. We often think that we're not motivated to do anything unless we're angry. But the problem is the behavior that we take on when we become angry is really not the highest human behavior, generally. So wouldn't it be interesting to try to make change in our lives and in the world from a place of love rather than from a place of anger? You know, it's like Gandhi saying, if you want to make change in the world, then become the change you wish to see in the world. And that, you know, most of us, and certainly at this point in time, wouldn't say, gee, I wish there were more angry people in the world. You know, I think we've got quite enough, thank you. and I would prefer to not be one of them.
Or in the same room.
Well, exactly. But that doesn't mean to, I don't want to say that if there is anger, that denying it is helpful, because that's not helpful either. You know, there is anger. If we have human minds, we're probably going to have anger, because we have judgment and we have fragile human emotions. One thing that's really interesting that I spoke about quite a bit in the book is to recognize that anger is an expression of grief. That's something I learned from Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, that anger really is not a primary emotion, that if you examine yourself or most human beings when they're angry, the real emotion that's underneath the surface is either fear or hurt or a combination of the two, or disappointment, or, you know, something. So that what's really helpful is to, when there's anger, to keep asking, what is the suffering in this situation? What's causing this suffering? What is this person frightened about? What has hurt them? And to ask ourselves when we're angry, what am I frightened about and what has hurt me? That is really the beginning of the key to letting go of anger.
I have a question, because in the spiritual community, there is the belief that finding affinity for people that we interact with, you know, finding acceptance, kind of along the lines that you're talking about. And I know this is kind of a, you know, judgment call kind of question, but how do you tell the difference or between abuse, you know, how do people draw that line? Because I think people get very confused as to, I'm supposed to, you know, work on loving this person, you know, and giving them the opportunity to change and grow. And where do you draw that line, or what kind of things should you ask yourself about making that choice to move on or whatever?
Well, Dr. Rita, I think there's one really simple way to get a sense of whether a relationship is spiritually helpful or spiritually destructive. And that is to ask yourself, when you are interacting with this other person, do you feel larger or smaller? Because if the relationship is making you contract and feel small and feel like you have no self-esteem, and it is causing you to at times even hate yourself, I don't think it's very spiritually helpful. So it isn't so much. Now, I would say pretty much across the board, if you're being physically abused, get out, get away from that person. Do whatever you have to do, and if you have to call the police and have them locked up, call the police and have them locked up. You know, there is no benefit to that. But beyond that, you know, sometimes I can use the story of my father, who was one of those people who, when he was sober, was the nicest guy on earth. Everybody loved him, and when he drank, it only took one sip of alcohol, and he would turn into this raging, bellowing, miserable demon. And it was startling and unbelievable. People who had never seen him drink and then had the opportunity to see him when he was drunk, oh my goodness, they couldn't believe it, because it was a complete personality change. Now, then when, as he got older and I was caring for him, he became sort of abusive. He didn't have to drink to be abusive. He was just cranky much of the time, you know, because he was uncomfortable and he had lung cancer and a lot of pain in his body. Now, Ram Dass had said to me at one point when I was talking about my dad, he said, why don't you see him as your guru? Which to me at the time was an audacious statement. You know, I said, my father, you're that old so-and-so? my guru, and he said, yeah, who else could he be? Which was an interesting question. I said, yeah, who else could he be? So when I went back to start to deal with my father, that changed my relationship with him dramatically, but it took time. And it didn't change in the blink of an eye, but what it did was that from that point on, when he said something abusive to me, and I would react and get angry, I started to see, now that I saw him as my guru, I would say, instead of saying he shouldn't say that, I'd say, boy, he's really good at this. He's really good at getting me angry. And as long as he can do that, I'm still getting the teaching. So it went on for about 3 years, and over that time, little by little, I was able to be less and less reactive. Now, part of, you know, I had to do different things and try different strategies to deal with it. For instance, I realized if I visited him every day, I couldn't handle it. So I started visiting him every other day, and that would give me a day to recover, because I thought, better I see him half as often and be more loving toward him than I see him every day and get drowned in his stuff and my stuff. So I would see him every other day. Well, finally, one night I went to visit him, and he was living at home, and we had a hospital bed in his bedroom, you know, and we had around-the-clock nurses caring for him. And I went in to see him, and he was just being abusive. You know, he was being cranky and nasty. And finally, after 3 years of trying to see him as my guru, I looked him in the eyes, and I sincerely felt and said to him, Dad, I love you too. And when I said that, he relaxed. And he suddenly was all tense and cranky and raving. And when I said that to him, and I really meant it, he laid his head back on his pillow and he started to smile. And he looked up at the ceiling and he reached up. I was standing next to his bed, and he reached up and he started patting my left shoulder with his right hand. And he's smiling and he's going, good, good, good. And you know what I felt, Dr. Rita? I felt like I had just graduated. It was like, he just... You know, it was like he was saying to himself, thank God the kid finally got it. You know, that it isn't about me being nasty. It's about how loving he can be no matter what. And I can finally die in peace. And he died the next day.
Wow.
Now, that was an amazing experience. But so it's a long-winded answer to your question, which was, how do you determine? You know, I also, because he was my father, I was willing to take a lot more abuse from him than I would take from a romantic partner, you know, because what fun is that? But he was my father. I couldn't trade him in. You know, he was my father. That was given karma. And I wanted to do whatever I could do to heal my relationship with him while he was alive. And that became an extraordinary teaching in unconditional love. How to love this cranky old man unconditionally.
Question. So as he would push your buttons by being cranky and create some reaction in you, did you go home, you know, that night or, you know, during the next day and kind of meditate on what was going on or do some self-reflection as to, you know, this is what the situation was and what did he touch in me that created this reaction?
Exactly.
Was that kind of your little thing?
Yeah. Well, and I'll tell you, the first thing that I learned was that was when I became a really good jogger and started to get conscious of my own health because I found that jogging would dissipate that angry energy. You know, back in the old days when I worked with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, we used to teach people to beat on pillows and things like that. But I think that we've really realized that that's not the healthiest way to deal with it, because it really, in a sense, can reinforce the habit of becoming angry. So I found that, how can I do it in a way that isn't expressing anger? Well, I can just go out and run, you know, run really hard, do some intense aerobic activity, because that'll discharge a lot of the energy. once I did that, then I would come home and meditate. And I had an exercise that I developed in which I would visualize that I had a beautiful silver platter, and I would hold it up just sort of at the top of my forehead, and I would imagine this stream of stuff pouring out the top of my head that was my anger and my fear and my disappointment and all that, ugh, you know, and I would just put it on the silver platter. I'm envisioning this in meditation. And then I lift it up and I offer it to my guru. And I say, Baba, will you take this? Because I've had it with this stuff. I don't want to be angry at my father. I don't want to be in this state of agitation. Can you just take this from me? And I would visualize him taking it. Sometimes he'd throw it over his shoulder. He'd just kind of laugh, or, you know, he might even eat it. I don't know. It was just all, each time I did that, I would feel a little more free of it. And then I'd reflect on what it was in me. You know, what were those buttons? I mean, my friend Stephen Levine used to say, our parents are really good at pressing our buttons because they installed all of them. They know right where they are. So, though, and you know, it's interesting because most of the time we have problems with our parent of the same sex. Women have problems with their mothers and men have problems with their fathers. You know, that's not always the case, but more often than not, it's interesting that that's the way it pans out. So, you know, my dad was the relationship that I most wanted to heal in this life. It was the most difficult relationship and the one I most wanted to heal.
And you had a chance to, and you got... The end of your story is really interesting. It sounds like, to me, that your dad just wanted to be loved and experience love, and he probably had never experienced that or not that much of it. And when you had that moment of radiating love to him, he finally got what he had been yearning for years.
That's what everybody wants. Love mm-hmm. is what everybody wants. And it's, I mean, the meanest, grisliest person you've ever met in your life, at the core of their being, what they really want is love. And, you know, through whatever series of wounds that they've taken emotionally and psychologically over the course of their life, they've gotten into this sort of perverted stance of being so hurt by the world that they're at war with it all the time, when what they really want is love. It's amazing. It's so simple. And that, I mean, I don't want to be this to be pie in the sky to say that necessarily you can always respond to someone who's violent or abusive with love and have that convert them in the blink of an eye, but it could work that way. You know, it could. I remember a story, maybe, you know, I'm conflicted about telling it because the woman who's...
Yeah, we have about 7 minutes just to give you a little heads up.
Okay, great. Well, I can tell it sort of quickly. But it was a friend of mine who was a Zen Buddhist practitioner for many, many years, was at a conference in Washington, D.C. a number of years ago, and she had that experience that we've heard about where she was entering her hotel room and a man suddenly appeared and pushed her into the hotel room, came in behind her, locked the door, pushed her to the ground, was very violent, and he was going to rape her. And she's laying there on her back on the ground, and she looks up at him, and she looks in his eyes and puts her hand on his cheek and says, don't do this. This is wrong. And she said it very lovingly, and he was so stunned, and he stood up, and he ran out of her room. Now, she herself said, as she told me this story, she said she was reluctant to tell it, because she said, I don't know that that's the right thing to tell people to do if they're in that circumstance, but in that moment, that was what came to me, and it worked. And in my moment with my father, I gave him love and he softened.
And I think when we have those moments, they have to be real. They have to be spontaneous. I mean, just you know, if you're scared to death and you say that to a potential rapist, I don't think it's going to come off in the same way.
Right, exactly. It's the vibration that you're sending out. And if you're at a, you know, but she had cultivated inner peace for decades, you know, so she was ready for that moment. You know, so it's that sort of emphasizes why it's useful for us to do our spiritual work, because it prepares us for those kinds of moments in life when we might really be able to be so rooted in peace that we could change a circumstance like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, let's do our meditations and and work on it. Get ready. You know, our culture doesn't prepare us for the really heavy stuff in life. And that's why it's so difficult to handle when it comes up. Whereas if we did prepare, you know, it would be more like we're going through life practicing Aikido or something like that. You know, when the threats and dangers present themselves, we just can redirect the energy in another way. But if you haven't practiced, you don't have the ability to do that.
Well, and to do that, you really have to be able to find the big S. You know, it needs
That's
to come
right.
from the big S, not the small S.
That's
and if you
as in between,
don't have that
between R and
C. And if you don't have that relationship, you know, it might be kind of hard.
That's right.
Or come off fake.
That's right. To be really rooted in the authentic self, the true self, your soul, that is something that most people respond to because it's vibrating in that place in them. You become an environment in which they can touch that in themselves, or your words or just your presence can touch it in them, and they respond, you know, but it does take practice. Yeah.
John, we have 2 minutes left.
Uh-huh.
So your book, if somebody wanted to get a copy of it, where can they go to find it?
It's called One Soul, One Love, One Heart: The Sacred Path to Healing All Relationships. It's published by New World Library. It's available on the online booksellers. It's available in all bookstores. If they don't have it in stock, they can order it. Again, published by New World Library, One Soul, One Love, One Heart. My last name is spelled Welshons. I'm on Facebook. People can join my Facebook community or go to my website, which is onesoulonelove.com. And we don't sell the book online, but you can get it from the traditional online booksellers. So it's really available through all traditional book buying channels.
Do you do classes, workshops, anything like that? If people wanted to spend some more time with you,
Absolutely.
How would they find out information about that?
On the website, onesoulonelove.com, in the right-hand column, there are a series of links, and one of them says John Welshon's schedule, and they can click on that, and we update that regularly so they can see where I'm teaching. And also, I do one-on-one consultations by phone or in person in my office in New Jersey, so if they live in the area, it's great, or we can talk by telephone just as you and I are doing. And if they'd like information about that, they can email me through the website or through Facebook.
John, there's the music, which means we are out of time.
Okay.
Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you, Dr. Rita. It's been such a pleasure being with you.
We're going to have you come on. I think we have more to talk about.
Okay. Anytime.
So, okay. That's John Welshon. His book is One Soul, One Love, One Heart. His webpage is onesoulonelove.com. And I'm Dr. Rita Louise.
Just Energy Radio with your host, Dr. Rita Louise, will return right after these messages.
Deep inside yourself and venture into the realm of the unconscious mind with my Meditating on the Kabbalah guided imagery audio CDs. discover who you are and what you want in life. Meditating on the Kabbalah can help you to open, clear, and revitalize the energetic pathways of your subtle being. They will support you in your spiritual quest by helping you to access the profound insights and inner guidance you need as you work in alignment with your highest good. Let them help you to release negative thoughts and emotions and clear away any limitations that may be keeping you from experiencing your full potential. Walk down the path to health, healing, understanding, and enlightenment with Meditating on the Kabbalah. Order your copy today at www.soulhealer.com. That's right, that's www.soulhealer.com. Balance in all things is critical to maintaining health. In the hectic drive of today's world, many of us forget to take care of our most important asset, ourselves. At productsforthesoul.com, we want to support your effort to nurture yourself. We offer a wide variety of herbs, supplements, and high-quality, ready-to-eat, all-natural foods. We even have guilt-free chocolates. Best of all, our products are delivered straight to your door. It's time to start loving yourself. Visit productsforthesoul.com and start loving yourself today.
You can get a copy of Dr. Rita's latest book, Avoiding the Cosmic 2x4, by visiting www.soulhealer.com. Get your copy today.